Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a channel within the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today on the program, we have Dr. Thomas A. Foster, an Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professor of History at Howard University. Dr. Foster is here to discuss his new book, published by our friends at the University of Georgia Press, entitled Rethinking Rufus, Sexual Violations of Enslaved Men. In the spirit of transparency and care for our listeners, the subject matter involved in today's discussion of Rethinking Rufus may, for some, be triggering, so just want to put that out there. But with that said, thank you for coming on the program today, Dr. Foster. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
Most definitely. And so before we get, you know, too knee-deep in the book, can you talk to us how you got to this particular project?
Sure. The project started out initially as an article that I started almost 10 years ago, actually. And the impetus for that article came from teaching history of sexuality in undergraduate classes at DePaul University, where we would study sexual exploitation of enslaved women and had really nothing to work with in terms of scholarship or even primary sources for the students to study or even discuss the possibility of sexual exploitation of enslaved men. And the more I taught that class and the more I worked with those documents, I began to see in the documents perhaps another story, and I just became really curious about exploring that story. And that became sort of just that initial article, which I can say more about later if you'd like. But that's sort of the initial start for the project.
Awesome. And as well with that, you know, I'm very much interested to know how scholars and such, because, you know, we have a differing audience of folks. We have some folks who are scholars themselves, like some people like my mom, who are real interested to know what are all the books that her son is reading in school. So can you lay out maybe some of the intellectual communities that help to nurture Rethinking Rufus?
Let's see. My background is actually in women's history originally, and then I moved into the history of sexuality, focusing specifically on men and manhood in the 18th century in British America for my first book. So I had been immersed in, say, the history of sexuality in 17th, 18th century America for quite a while, for a number of projects before I started this project on slavery. And so I think I came to the study from a slightly different avenue than some of the scholars that I eventually corresponded with and interacted with on conference panels and other discussions, in that they were typically scholars of slavery, and I had not been a scholar of slavery. And so I was bringing my background in the history of gender and sexuality to primary sources in slavery. And had to sort of, you know, re-educate myself to study up on a secondary sources on slavery to have the context and background that I needed to work with those sources. I think the background in the history of sexuality and gender certainly gave me a different approach to the sources, and that I was looking for different connections between sexuality and gender, particularly for men and manhood. And I was also perhaps more sensitive or aware to manhood and masculinity in a way that perhaps other scholars are not, if they're not sort of immersed in that literature.
Yeah, and I say that and ask that in part because previously I had doctors Dinah Remy Berry and Dr. Harris, Leslie Harris, that is, on the program in, I guess it would have been late December, for their edited volume, Sexuality and Slavery. And that's actually how I came across your book as well, because you had a contribution, which was Chapter 7, The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery, and they referenced the fact that you were that you had an upcoming book in 2019. And so it's interesting because those scholars are in part very close to your book as well. Can you talk a bit about that connection before as well?
Yeah, it's a vital connection for the book. I don't know that the book would exist really without Dr. Berry's encouragement and support and sort of recognition of the significance of the work. And so for me, I wanted to do the article to make the initial point that in fact, I thought many of the sources that we had in front of us, in fact, sources that many people had already published and written about from the vantage point of enslaved women in those sources. I thought many of those same sources needed to be looked at because they also told us things about enslaved men's experiences with regards to sexual violations. And so the article for me was satisfying in terms of sketching out broadly what I saw in the documents and in the sources. I had the intention of perhaps writing another article. I really wasn't sure, but I was going to continue reading through sources and exploring different topics. So I thought perhaps I had two articles here, maybe three, and pretty early on connected with the group of scholars that formed that edited volume that you referenced on Sexuality and Slavery. And there were two different conferences actually that came along the way as part of putting that volume together. So there was a really rich environment with a number of really dynamic scholars that were looking at sexuality and slavery. And I was able to, even though I did not have original research and they all did, I just had the article. I was able to join that group because it filled a void in the work that was being done at the time that they were putting together that volume. So they definitely wanted the article. So that chapter is actually a reprint of the original, I think it's a 2011 article. Whereas the other pieces I think are all original. Work to that volume. So the response to the article and the discussions that happened in putting together that volume with that community that formed really led me to want to push this to make it a book, to make really sort of fully explore it and see what could come out that way. So
yeah, and we're all the better for it as a scholar and lay people alike. And so now that we've talked about, you know, more of the intellectual communities that helped to nurture this, and also that, you know, this is greatly a part of UGA's sexual gender and slavery series headed by Dr. Jennifer Morgan at NYU and Dr. Dinah Remy Berry, I believe, as well part of the project at UT Austin. Can you as well, you know, talk about your title? So, you know, Rethinking Rufus, who was Rufus and why was he so integral to your study?
So that title actually came late to the project. Initially, I was exploring titles that used the word rape, the rape of Rufus or the rape of Rufus question mark. There were a few conference papers that carried that title. With that feedback, I became increasingly uncomfortable using the word rape in the title. It seemed a bit perhaps sensational or exploitive. And so I went back to really the original impetus for the project, which, as I mentioned, was that History of Sexuality class at DePaul University. And the document actually that was at the core of that was an interview with Rose Williams, a woman who was enslaved in Texas and did an interview with the WPA in the early 20th century where she talked about her experiences being forced to reproduce and set up a household with a man named Rufus. He doesn't have a last name in her interview. We don't have an interview with him. In fact, we have no documents from him. But I thought that what we could do to sort of frame the study was use her interview to try to tease out and read between the lines what might have been his experiences. And I wanted to humanize the story. So I knew that I wanted very much to highlight the voices of enslaved people, specifically enslaved men. And so I was very drawn to the idea of framing the book around a particular individual to further ground the story and further humanize it. And so I ended up with Rethinking Rufus. It really probably should be Thinking Rufus, in that we were not thinking about Rufus for the most part when we read the document about Rose Williams. I include myself in that. I taught that document several times in classes and never mentioned anything about Rufus's experiences. And in the end, I went with Rethinking Rufus because, in fact, what had been happening, and I saw this at least in my classes, is the absence of information about enslaved men's possible sexual violations ended up being filled in by my students with an assertion that men were not sexually violated. So more than once I heard students say, as a preface to a question, "We know enslaved men weren't sexually violated, but X or but Y," and then they'd continue with their question. And I thought, well, that's a really interesting formulation. And it seemed actually pretty in keeping with what we do in general with histories. If it hasn't been written about or studied, I think there's a tendency to assume it didn't happen, rather than just sort of holding an uncomfortable question mark, if you will, or an uncomfortable silence in that record, in that knowledge. And so for me, Rethinking Rufus really fit, because in fact, my students had been thinking Rufus, right? They'd been thinking about Rufus in uninformed or at least unsupported ways, I should say, by the documents. And so that was where Rethinking Rufus came from. Second part of the title, if I'm not going on too long for you here, also took a lot of thought and a lot of wrestling with sort of word choice here. And the fact that there's a lot of wrestling with word choice for me spoke to the fact that we really don't have language to talk about sexual violations of enslaved men or sexual violations of men really, even today, I would say. And so we just don't really have the vocabulary there. I went in the end with sexual violations rather than sexual violence, because I thought sexual violence had perhaps a little too much contemporary currency. And so there's always sort of loaded assumptions around that. So I wanted to unsettle that just a little bit by changing it to violations. And that's how the title came to be.
Right. And for me, I you know, right on, I've really been thinking about, as I've been doing my own work too, thinking about kind of the assumptions that folks have when they come into projects, and thinking about what it particularly is about something like, you know, something like sexual violation. Because I also noticed very early on while reading your book that, you know, you made it a point to say sexual violation as opposed to, you know, another term like, you know, sexual violence or rape. And so that was something that I noticed very, very early in your work. But then also it made me think about disciplinary constructions as well. And so would you consider this book to be, right, something that would be more so interdisciplinary than simply, maybe not simply might not be the word, but as opposed to just a book of history?
I think it's pretty in keeping with the approach I've taken from the beginning of my career, in that a lot of my interpretation of documents is informed, at least, or the conceptualization of the project is very much informed by gender studies, the history of sexuality, other interdisciplinary fields. But I think that I'm also a very traditional historian at the same time. And so for me, that means being cautious about claims about limited source bases. And one thing I try very hard to do in the project is to link up limited sources. But if you find a similar comment in one place and time, and you find it in another place and time, and you find it sort of in a whole host of different types of documents, different locations, different contexts, There's a way in which that sort of accrues to say, at least ultimately what I conclude, and that is that sexual violence is endemic to slavery. And that, of course, there's going to be all sorts of different ways in which that is practiced or realizes itself in different times and places. And honestly, I hope that the book is really the first word on this, at least in a monograph form, rather than, I had never intended this to be the last word on it, certainly not. And so the hope is that other scholars will pick up and perhaps give more depth, more change over time, more contextual differences in their own work, I would hope.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And I definitely think, at least based upon the Twitter conversations, which, you know, I think both of us have been very much attuned to, a lot of folks across varying disciplines, including history, obviously, as well, have been really not only excited about the book right before it came out, but upon receiving and reading the actual book. I think a lot of us have really, I think personally, been challenged by your book in kind of like pushing our potential assumptions about, you know, how enslaved men were sexually violated. And so that actually brings me to think, as the actual person writing the book, what challenges did this book provide you?
Well, any project presents a whole host of challenges. This one in particular for me, because of the topic, there were a number of things that I wrestled with early on. Those tended to dissipate once I resettled and resolved a few things for me about approach and what I wanted the book to do. And so early on, there were all sorts of questions that I had for myself in terms of how I wanted to speak to readers, how I wanted the historical documents to be presented, how I wanted to craft the story. And so I knew that I wanted to highlight the voices of enslaved people. I knew that I wanted to spend little to no time exploring the mindset of enslavers. I was not interested in having, you know, you could imagine another book perhaps that's a truly full story that talks about the victimizers, the victims, the whole gamut, basically. I felt like because this was the first monograph on the subject, and because there was a need to actually have enslaved men and women talking about this, that I wanted to highlight those sources. And so in at least one chapter, the WPA narratives figure very heavily, but in most of the chapters, the source base is majority produced by enslaved or formerly enslaved people. And so that would be narratives or biographies, memoirs, different things like that. And so this is just one example of one of the challenges I had, and that's just in terms of how I wanted to frame the study. And so you'll notice in the book, you do not see a lot about enslavers or people talking about justifying to themselves or explaining why they do what they do. That was not something that I felt needed to be explored in this project.
And also to the point of organization, how did you construct the text in the sense of, you know, you did not go like chronologically, right? And this project wasn't really, you know, pushed towards that particular bend. So how did you choose, as the scholar writing the book, how did you choose to really craft the book as far as how to divide the particular book up? Because I always find, you know, especially as someone who's very much used to the chronological order of things when it comes to writing history, that when I see scholars who don't use that approach, I'm always fascinated to see how do they choose the organizational structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know historians and readers approaching history have a different interest, basically, in change over time or not. And so I've never been a real history is the study of change over time type of historian. And I know there's a ton of historians out there that are horrified to hear me say that. But particularly for this project, to argue that at a base point, I was trying to establish that enslaved men were sexually violated in a whole range of ways because of enslavement. And so change over time is something I hope that other scholars may do something with if they can, have enough sources, a rich enough source base to get at that. For me, like I said, I had never started this as an actual book, so I didn't have a book proposal with six proposed chapters, as you know historians typically do, and then pursue it that way. It grew very organically initially as the article, which I then thought formed a decent model for the book, which was topically. And then as I started to explore the possibility of developing this into a book or at least a handful of articles, I really just spent a lot of time reading through the available sources, all of the sort of traditional sources that people use to study slavery, and to see what topics came out of those sources ultimately. And that's what organized the book. For me, the sources really spoke to me in terms of how I wanted to organize the project.
And with that too, one of the chapters, I love the entire book, right? We mentioned online, offline, you know, this is going to definitely be a book on my comps list. Hey, Dr. Dunbar. And so, for going forward at Rutgers, but the chapter that really was the most like awe striking, I would say, was actually your final chapter, which is entitled, for those who don't have the book presently, Till I Had Mastered Every Part: Valets, Vulnerability, and Same Gender Relations Under Slavery. I thought that chapter was the most striking, in part because the question of masculinity is always something that is undergirding just a lot of conversations just generally, because I just don't think a lot of people have a lot of true understanding of gender and of, you know, sex and of, you know, the particular terms that you as a scholar of gender would know. So can you talk a bit about that particular chapter? Because we're not going to talk about all of them, but just that one was one that really, as the host, the host privilege, I guess, just asking about that particular chapter, if you don't mind.
Sure. And actually, one of the things that chapter is a good example of, going back to the question about challenges, is that I wanted to have the book not only talk about violations, but also talk about, to put it in a particular context for what was being violated at the time, to historically contextualize the violations, and rather than impose a current assessment of what is a violation, if you will. And so you see that in a couple of other chapters. You see that in this case, in that last chapter, it operates in the same chapter where you've got a section that talks about the custom, the practice, the accepted notion of bonds between enslaved men, bonds of love, bonds of tenderness, bonds of intimacy, that existed. And so you have that to then talk about what is being violated in that time period when there are same gender violations of enslaved men. In the rest of the book, in another part of the book, it's actually in two different chapters where you see that sort of juxtaposition. In that you've got the chapter on which highlights enslaved men's voices talking about the way that they pride themselves in selecting spouses, in risking punishment for selecting loved ones, and resent being broken up from chosen lovers or partners. And you have that in contrast to the chapter on coerced reproduction, also to talk about exactly what is being violated there. And that is a norm at the time that enslaved men embraced and nurtured and established really for themselves of autonomy over selecting a spouse. And so I just wanted to say that it's one of the first things I think of when I think of that chapter, in that I don't think most people would have expected that chapter to also have a component of love. I don't think people would expect the book to have components of love and resistance in the book, particularly from the title and particularly from people who are triggered by the topic and will stay away from the book. I don't think the framing perhaps does justice to the richness, I think, of the story. And that was something that I really wanted to communicate. On the one hand, I wanted to communicate and took pains in the introduction to be very explicit that this is not a history of sexuality for enslaved men. This is a particular focus on sexual violations of enslaved men. I did not want to contribute to a pathologizing of enslaved men's sexuality, or even say that these violations are at the core or drive understandings of sexuality. This in no way has a broader understanding of the history of sexuality here been broached. I wouldn't want to see this book as doing justice to the history of sexuality for enslaved men. So it's a component of that. And one component of that is this chapter on same gender violations. There's not a great deal of work out there on bonds of intimacy among enslaved men. There's emerging work in the area, so I'm happy to contribute to those discussions. And there's certainly a lot of contemporary discussions about sexual violations of enslaved men that are same gender. That, I think, finds its way into the popular culture in ways that I'm quite uncomfortable with. And I do, in the introduction to that chapter, talk about the fact that I think there's some homophobia or uncomfortableness with same gender love today that uses those particular violations, which happened, as a way to symbolize the ultimate depravity of slavery, if you will. And I think that's quite problematic. And in fact, I've been in discussions before where people will bring up buck breaking, which is not figure in the book, which I have not been able to find documentation for. And I'm very curious to actually connect with people who have studied this. I'd love to see original documents to understand where that comes from. My understanding is that the argument is basically that that is so heinous that it is the way that individuals would break down an enslaved man by penetrating him sexually or humiliating him in a same gender sexual violation. But I think one of the things that the book shows is that for enslaved men, I mean, the ultimate violation is being ripped from your wife and children or being forced to have a particular partner and reproduce. And you see that very clearly in their writings and their complaints about those violations. And so I did not see any of the same writing or complaints about same gender violations in that way. And so that is why I'm very suspicious of sort of how that gets crafted, if you will, and where I'm suspicious about trying to disentangle our own contemporary discomfort with same gender love from the time period itself. But I don't know if I've hit any of your questions or interest in that chapter. So you may want to ask more questions about it if you want.
Oh, no, like you actually did touch on them greatly, because actually in part why I asked that. So earlier today when I was working, I always like to have something in the background to listen to. And I came across actually a discussion at the second annual Malcolm X Day symposium at Uncle Bobby's bookstore in Philadelphia. And so the topic actually was Malcolm X and the politics of masculinity. And for those who may know, the late great Manning Marable wrote that pioneering biography of Malcolm X. And in the book, he talks about, you know, Malcolm X engaging in same gender sex. And so that was something that a lot of people, you know, push against. And they'll always ask, you know, what sources are you using, this and this? And it actually, I think, goes to what you're talking about when it comes to the under, I wouldn't even say it's underground, but it, you know, homophobia just generally. And so that's how you touching on the topic in the way that you, or that chapter rather, when you the way you did, to me at least anyway, broached all of the particular areas that I was thinking about. And actually a follow-up question to that too, because I know you had mentioned just then about the buck breaking, and yes, I've heard that if you go on certain areas of Facebook or Twitter, you'll find that, and it's a pretty gross place to be at. But one thing that they some folks will talk about were the role of white women in the sexual violation of enslaved men. And so with that, could you talk to us a bit about what your research found on that particular topic?
Yeah, I think that's perhaps the most speculative of the chapters, in that one of the things I want to do in that chapter is at least get people thinking about the fact that we have a wide occurrence that's documented and known, and scholars have not scholars have been aware of this for quite a while, of white women and enslaved men in relationships. The scholars that have focused on those relationships have primarily been women's historians, and they primarily talk about what it means for those white women in those relationships. As someone who studied women's history and is committed to women's history, I appreciate that perspective. I appreciate the recognition of the ways in which those white women are going against a patriarchal system defining their lives, that in many ways they are making their own choices. But I think what fell out of those discussions entirely is what it would have meant for these enslaved men, the power imbalance in those relationships. And for me, it was incredibly jarring, coming from the history of sexuality and being fully aware of how we approach the histories that talk about relationships between white men and enslaved black women as exploitive. I mean, depending on which scholar you talk to, either all of them are rape or they are various, you know, degrees of exploitation and violation. So I was really struck by the fact that on the one hand, when you look at enslaved men with white women, you have almost this, I mean, to be a little bit flip, it's almost a characterization of love across the color line. Even in, people will talk about this even in the 17th and 18th centuries. And on the other hand, you have rape in all cases, because the person is, one person is enslaved, one person is free. And so I wanted to make that point in that chapter. I begin by at least showing us, you know, laying all that out. Ultimately, I've got a few suggestive instances, one case in particular where it's in Kentucky in the 1840s, I believe, where a white woman and an enslaved man had a household. Ultimately, the courts have to determine who owns that property. And so there is testimony from, I think it's three different neighbors, actually, that testified to the same dynamic in that relationship. And the quote from a couple of them is something along the lines of, whenever they fought, she threatened to sell him unless he behaved. And this was considered to be a marriage or a relationship. And so I thought, well, it's one quote. It's very difficult to characterize a relationship based on just one quote. But it certainly was a tantalizing clue to a self-consciousness about the power imbalance in that relationship. And I wanted, as scholars, for us to approach those relationships in a different way. And so, again, I hope that that chapter sort of sparks more research with that perspective in mind and finds more evidence. It was extremely hard for me to get at the dynamic within those relationships, and it's not entirely surprising. As we all know today, interpersonal relationships are extremely complex. It would be pretty troubling for any, you know, one or two emails of our own to be ripped out of context and have a person generalize about our personal relationships based on that day's communication, right? But I certainly found that quote telling, and I do think that as scholars, we need to keep in mind that power imbalance, particularly because we know that white women were violent, were seen, you know, saw themselves as key players in enslavement, were fully involved, as you know, new work is showing in great detail. Stephanie Jones Rogers' book that's out now is fantastic in that regard, and really showing us that there's a whole other story that had not been considered, and is really a corrective to a literature that was established by early women's historians, who were again, you know, focusing on the experiences of those white women in a way that was, you know, quite a narrow narrow focus. But again, to put that in its own context, it was coming out of a body of literature that focused on enslaved men and gave no regard, not enslaved men, free men, male masters and enslavers, and gave no regard to the experiences of white women at that time. And so, you know, there's a progression here for people who are interested in historiography that you can see. And I'm glad to see we're now at a point where we're getting a much fuller story that is told.
Most definitely. And part of the reason why I also, you know, asked that question, too, is I had Dr. Stephanie Jones Rogers on a few months ago about her book on white women as well. And so, you know, in the short couple minutes that we have left, can you talk to us a bit about, now that the project is over, looking back, what did you, if at all, learn? You know, what was the thing that you would say coming out of this project you learned the most about the sexual violation of enslaved men?
And that's a great question. It's such an obvious question. I should have been prepared for it, but this is the first podcast I've done on the book. So
all right.
I need to think about this. Honestly, I think throughout the project, I was surprised at how much was there. You know, again, I had not intended for this to be a book, partly because I wasn't sure how much of this was documented. I felt pretty satisfied by the article that I had found what shards of evidence exist to help us begin to imagine what was going on at the time. I didn't know that I'd be able to find enough to do a book. And, you know, that I did not find untapped sources that were in someone's attic or basement or hidden in some archive somewhere. I used sources that everyone have, you know, they've been using the same sources for so long that I found, I think that was perhaps most interesting to me, that the sources were there, that people were talking about sexual violations, and that in so many different types of sources and so many different contexts, you could see this. So I think that's one of the things when I look at the book, you know, I come away still overwhelmed, I think, by the variety of sources, the variety of, unfortunately, of violations, contexts, and ways in which that was recorded for us.
And Tubes, I know I mentioned this when we were getting ready for the interview. You know, you're a scholar now that is at Howard, and so, you know, you're at a, you know, historically black college, you know, so, some would say the most preeminent one, and you're also by virtue of that in an important scholarly community, and so, you know, this is a part of my HBCU feature series, in part why I have you on right now. So can you, in the brief amount of time we have left, talk to, you know, what HBCUs, on a side note for this space here, can you talk to us a bit about what being at an HBCU, you know, coming from now from DePaul previous, what, you know, what that means for you as a scholar doing this work and also thinking about, you know, scholarly communities to tap into as well?
So I've been at Howard for a year and a half now. It's been a fantastic experience. I'm thrilled to be part of a welcoming community of scholars at a place that supports, nurtures, and develops undergraduates, graduate students, faculty of color, predominantly African American and Black, and so it's a terrific place to be. The book was primarily written at DePaul University, which is a predominantly white institution, and I'm not in the classroom yet. I'm in an administrative position, and so I'm very excited to see how the book is received at Howard. I'm scheduled to give a book talk at Howard in November, so I've got a ways to go. The initial reception has been really quite positive for the work. And as I said, I'm really happy to be here. I don't know that the history of sexuality has been explored as much at Howard as I explored it at DePaul. And so I'm pleased to be able to contribute that, I think, to the discussions here. But Howard's a unique place, an important place, and a place that contributes not only to the community that's here, but it's really making a contribution to the country and the world, frankly. And you see Howard alum all over the world.
Absolutely. You see them all up and through Black Panther, that's for sure. Okay. Among many other spaces too. And so, thank you so much, Dr. Foster, for being with us today. And, once again, folks, I've been on New Books in African American Studies, a channel within the New Books Network, to talk to Dr. Thomas A. Foster, who, as he just said, is an Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professor of History at Howard University. And not only that, the Howard University as well. And I'm Adam McNeil, your host, a 2015 graduate of the History Department at Florida A&M University. Which was founded October 3rd of 1887, if you didn't already know. And so with that, folks, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And, usually I get mine from Apple Podcasts, but, we're all around, Stitcher and the like, too. So please go subscribe where you get your podcasts, especially if you like the content. And please rate us and review us because we always love to see how we're doing as a community of hosts. And so, until next time, folks, once again, I'm Adam McNeil, Florida A&M University graduate, Simmons College graduate, and soon to be a Rutgers University, New Brunswick PhD student in history. Until next time, folks, again, over and out.